I was speaking to one of the musicians earlier this week, and he told me that you have a great gift for telling interesting anecdotes about the music to the musicians. Any truth to this rumour?
Oh, well, it's very nice of them to say so. You know, one of the things I think is very important is people like Bach were real people. I mean, musical genius, yes, but he also liked a glass of beer. He smoked a pipe. He had several interests. One of the few things that survives is his wine glass, which is in beautiful engraved etched crystal, saying that it's from his friends. We know that he owned a silver coffee pot and grand coffee service. So yeah, he was a man. He was a human being. Had, as you say, a very large family. Can you imagine telling bedtime stories in the Bach family?
Go on. It would be a recital.
It would be a recital, yeah. So he had a sense of humour, we presume. So one's apt to think of composers as writing this music as if they're not, they're sort of separate from the rest of us. And actually, they're not. And so I do say some things about, you know, that I've been to Curtin where this music was written. I've actually been to a concert in Leipzig where I sat closer to Bach than the musicians because he's buried right there and I was sitting right beside him. I didn't hear any rolling, so I assumed he liked it. So, you know,
he wasn't twisting in his grave.
He wasn't twisting in his grave or shouting. So I find that just that sort of thing absolutely fascinating too. I had a run-in with Bach's head a couple of years ago because
a run-in with his head.
Well, I turned the corner and there was his head. What they had done in Germany is that the cemetery where he was buried was dug up in the end of the 19th century, and they found what they are pretty sure is Bach. It wasn't quite where he was supposed to be. He was a few feet away, but they found the right sort of guy. And so they made a bronze copy of his skull. And then about 5 years ago, the Germans made a sort of a computerized version of that and made it out of plaster or whatever and gave it to one of these police reconstruction people without saying who it was. And she did the usual police reconstruction stuff. And
is it forensic artist? Forensic, I think
yes.
Yeah, there was a famous one actually from Philadelphia who died
yes.
recently.
And so they put a wig on it and when it was finished, and she didn't know it was an 18th century chap, and it looks incredibly like the portrait. He has a overbite, I should say.
Dental care wasn't then what it is now, I'm guessing.
Well, not quite, but it would have helped him speak Leipzig German, perhaps. But it does look incredibly like him. And I think it was 2009, this head was on exhibition in Eisenach, in the house where he wasn't born. They tell you it's the Bach birth house, but he was actually born around the corner in a much less fancy house, which they pulled down in the last century.
Right, but you can't get as many tourists. You couldn't get as many tourists in there.
Yeah, so they've created this house to be sort of Bach's house. It actually isn't. In the same way as his house in Leipzig doesn't exist anymore, because it was pulled down in the early 20th century.
Oh.
But his composing room was actually photographed, which is amazing. So you can actually see where he wrote stuff in a rather drab little photograph, but it's all that survived.
And having told them these, I mean, really interesting anecdotes, then what are you wanting from them? Because these Brandenburg concertos can be played with anything from the smallest of ensembles right up to a symphony orchestra. What does it bring to them to have them played by this amount of musicians?
Well, we're playing them in, I hope, a sufficiently large orchestra that makes sense of being in the Kimmel Center.
So to fill the room.
To fill the room enough, which is perhaps why we're not doing Brandenburg 6, which really is chamber music. These pieces, although they're classed as orchestra music, are really grand chamber music. The hall in Curtin where these pieces were presumably first performed still exists, although it was redecorated in the 19th century to make it look more sort of neoclassical. The proportions of it are still there, and I suppose it holds about 60 to 80 people comfortably. And so it's sort of between a chamber music. Again, it's between chamber music and an orchestra. Bach probably had close to solo players, because the one thing that we do have is basically who got paid, how many people were in the orchestra. And it's probably 8 or 10, with a few people doubling instruments, Bach playing both the harpsichord and the violin, and so on. So, and he could always bring in mates from Halle to, and when his trumpet-playing friend came past, he could give him something wicked to play.
And he did. Many wicked.
So we're making, I hope, making sense that it is really the Philadelphia Orchestra rather than a sort of Jenny Craig version of it. So it's not slimmed down so much that you won't recognise it. That whenever you do a bunch of Brandenburgs, the problem is that you have to move the furniture between each one because they all need a different setup. We're using kind of fun setup for Brandenburg 1 where the strings are basically all on one side and the winds are all on the other, which makes for great stereo. And it also makes it much easier to play the solo parts because they can hear each other. And we are using certain modern things like Brandenburg 2 and Brandenburg 4 written for recorders rather than for modern transverse flutes. But since recorders are not part of a modern symphony orchestra and you have great flute players here, it just makes sense to use the regular flutes.
And how far do you take that? Because you have a great affinity with original music and with original practices. Is there a negotiation between you and the orchestra as to how much it remains the Philadelphia Orchestra and how much it becomes about it being played in a manner that's respectful to the time music was written, or does that matter at all?
Well, I first came here in about 1998, and we actually did two of the pieces on this program, Suite 3 and Brandenburg 3, when the orchestra was considerably less used to playing this kind of music than they are now. I think with Suite 3, it was the first time that the orchestra had played it since the 1920s in its entirety. Wow. They'd done the air on the G string a lot, but not the whole piece. And now, lots of players have retired, younger generation has come in who've been much more used to playing
lots of different
music, have been exposed to period instruments, even if they're not actually actually played them very much. One of the cellists is using an 18th century bow, which is terrific, the late 18th century bow, which is lighter, and so it's easier to play the millions of notes that Bach chose to write for the cello. And I don't have to say, no vibrato this week. I generally have to say, you can use a little vibrato.
Oh,
it's okay. Fine.
Oh, really? Oh, because I would have thought, out of respect for you, that they would be very flat on the notes.
I'm actually saying use a little bit more.
Interesting.
Because they
and
did.
Why?
Well, they did use vibrato in the 18th century on what you might call the blue notes, the jazzy ones. So if you're in D major and you're playing a G sharp right. Or a B flat that aren't part of the key, it's okay to use a little vibrato, and the treatises say it's okay. Generally speaking, big orchestras didn't use vibrato, like Beethoven's orchestra, although it's clear that they probably did, because soloists used to use it. But Salieri actually went to a Beethoven period concert and criticised the orchestra for using a little vibrato. He said it's the province of soloists.
Hmm.
So it's more in the 19th century that you shouldn't use vibrato than in the 18th.
And what are the other things that would hold to being loyal to early music besides vibrato? Are there things in the winds?
Bowings. For example,
we come up against it then, because the Philadelphia Orchestra has its great bowing tradition.
Yes.
So
how do you compromise
on that?
For example, in the French overture, the suite, whereas 20 years ago, 18 years ago, no, last year, a lot of the bowings would be hooked. They're now unhooked like they would be. Basically, the bowings are basically Baroque bowings. They're fine. I always bring my own parts because it's easier. There's probably too much information in most of them. But at least what I want is written down, which means that we're not having to sort of invent things too much. We change things. For example, David Kim, who's working much harder than I am in this concert. He's playing three concertos and a suite, which has a big violin solo in it. He might want to do two down bows somewhere instead of down up, which is what's in the parts, and so we change to accommodate what he might want. And that's just
And that's about protecting the sound, then, isn't it?
Yes. And it's fine. Whatever he wants to do, he gets. And that's great.
Is there anything you won't compromise on?
Oh, no. Well, I will compromise on one thing, if it gets too serious.
Ah, okay.
Because this is some of the most joyous music ever written.
It certainly
and
is.
And you can sort of get very, I won't say German about it, but very earnest about it. And then once you do that, then it gets stodgy and it's hard to hear things. So I'm after definitely a lighter approach to it. And that means the textures become more transparent, and then it's easier to hear everything. So Christian, who's the associate conductor, has been out there balancing very carefully, because I can't tell from the podium. And so he's been doing the sort of musical camera work to make sure that the focuses are on the right people. And that's been incredibly helpful.
And how is he conveying that to you? He's standing at the back.
Because I ask him.
He's just shouting it to your.
No, he does the Nero approach. The thumb is either up or down to my questions.
I see, okay.
So I say, is that okay? And he thumbs up. Not okay. And then we change it. And it's fine.
What do you want audiences to take away from this?
How incredibly wonderful this music is. I think one of the things that. I don't know when this is being broadcast, but as this is the middle, towards the middle of April, and it's been a really bad week in this country. We've had the Boston Marathon explosions and then this awful explosion in Texas just last night or whenever. What I want is really people to come away with something really positive, a healing experience perhaps for some, but music is a joyous thing.
And these particularly do lift the heart.
They do lift the heart, and it's some of the finest music there is. One of the things I'm actually going to probably talk about this in the concert as well just beforehand is that there's a wonderful opera by Massenet called The Juggler of Notre Dame, in which the juggler goes in front of the altar of Notre Dame and starts juggling. And everyone says, this is sacrilegious, you can't do this in this holy place. He's saying, I'm doing the best thing that I can do. And for me and this glorious orchestra, playing music is the best thing that we can do. And that is the best thing that we can offer to the public and the listening public as well in this very tough time.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.